Morning.
Okay, hi everybody, hope you're doing well. And today again, we're doing basically a whirlwind tour. Each day we do a kind of a different topic, and obviously all of these topics deserve a lot more time and a lot more depth than we're able to give. But today we're going to talk a little bit about the old conflicts between religion and science. And the idea that I want to bring out to you is that in many, many ways, this is almost an imaginary question. It is not as important a question, in Judaism at least, as you would assume. Because we, in other words, obviously some rabbis might disagree with me as well, so I don't mean to, I'm not the Pope, so to speak. In other words, what I say is not the only position within the Jewish tradition, but I'm going to espouse a certain position within the Jewish tradition, and that is, it is essentially an apples and oranges type of problem, and that is, science deals with one aspect of reality, and Torah and Judaism and religion deals with another aspect of reality. They are addressing two fundamentally different types of questions, and therefore they are not in contradiction because they are talking about two different things. And that is to say, science is an attempt to discover what you might call the what of the universe, meaning what were the processes of creation, how do you describe physical reality, whether it's atoms, subatomic particles, and everything else. And as a result, science comes up with theories, some of which have more evidence, some of which have less evidence, so that's an important point. Don't believe every single scientific theory as reality, but science comes up with theories that have a certain amount of explanatory power, whether it be the Big Bang theory of the origin of the universe, whether it be Darwinian evolution. But the one thing that science cannot answer and does not attempt to answer is why all of these things happen. Meaning, science gives you the what, and religion, spirituality, Torah gives you the why. And any scientist will tell you that why certain things happened at certain times is not a scientific question. If you believe in God, you say it was guided, it was purposeful. If you don't believe in God, you say it was chaotic, it was random. So as a result, as a general matter, the what's of the universe has nothing to do with the why of the universe. And the Torah is not intended to be a scientific manual. That is frankly not the interest of the Torah. The Torah is intended to be a moral and spiritual guide for the purpose of my life and what my life is about. So a priori, there does not have to be a particular conflict between religious teachings and science. Now, there'll be some textual conflicts that one has to iron over, but let me state explicitly what I mean. The Torah can live with almost any type of scientific theory for the origin of the universe, as long as you believe that it was guided by God and was not random and chaotic. God is infinite, and because God is infinite, he has an infinite toolbox, an infinite number of tools that he used. So whether God used evolution, whether God used Big Bang, whether God did this or this did that, is not really a serious theological matter. Historically, Judaism has had much fewer problems with scientific theories than Christianity. In Christianity, the conflicts between religion and science have been very, very serious. As you know, Galileo was forced to recant publicly by the Catholic Church upon threat of actually being burnt at the stake. When Copernicus developed the idea that the Earth goes around the Sun instead of the Sun going around the Earth, there was a lot of problems within the Catholic Church because that displaced man as the center of the universe. In the Jewish tradition, you find little or no opposition to these various theories. As theories come down the pike, we simply assimilate them. That doesn't mean we accept them indiscriminately. Evolution itself, for example, there are many, many, many problems, and I'm not here to tell you what those problems are, but there are many problems. These things are far from certain, and I don't mean to suggest that because science says something, it's automatically true. That absolutely is not the case. And if you elevate science to absolute truth, you are developing a new religion called scientism, and that is every much of a religion as any other religion, and it has far less evidence than Judaism does, as we talked about yesterday. So I don't mean to suggest that whenever there's a conflict between science and Torah, science is right, God forbid, and Torah is wrong. I just mean to suggest that Torah can accommodate many, many different types of scientific understandings, because the scientific ways that God orchestrated the creation of physical laws, or orchestrated the creation of man, are not really the Torah's primary interest. The Torah is describing moral and spiritual truths, and science is the endeavor of mankind to try to understand the mechanics behind that endeavor. So this is a very, very general concept, which indicates that, frankly, science and religion are dealing with two different questions, and therefore there does not have to be a conflict. One does not have to look at Genesis as a scientific manual for creation. That was not the intention of the Torah. That was not the purpose of the Torah. The Torah can accommodate many theories. The only theory the Torah cannot accommodate is a theory of random, chaotic, undirected, unguided creative processes. As long as you believe God was in charge of this process, then we can live with almost everything. Now, I'll try to be more specific as I go on, but this is kind of the general orientation. So if you want to be a heretic or a non-believer, I have to say, you cannot do so because of the conflicts between the Torah and science. You're going to have to find another reason to do so. That reason is not a good one. Now, will you find people that disagree with what I just said? Yes, you will. So I'm not stating this to be a universally held belief, but it's a belief that I actually feel quite strongly about, that can be rooted in many, many sources. I think it's very, very useful, because as a result, scientific studies, scientific discoveries, whether it's age of the universe, whether it's the age of man, whether it's the process of evolution, and again, I do hasten to add that there are many, many holes in these theories, but even if one were convinced to accept them, it would not be a fundamental threat to one's religious orientation. Now, we actually find an opposite idea, and this goes back to the Psalms, but it was reiterated by Maimonides, that the deeper one's understanding of nature, the more one senses the presence of God. One sees the wonders of the universe. One sees the multiplicity of phenomena that are ultimately reduced in an elegant structure to a few basic laws. Let's say four basic forces, and now, as you know, physicists are seeking for one unifying force that would be the theory of everything. I had mentioned yesterday that every scientist intuitively grasps that there's some type of unitary elegance in the structure of the universe. And that is actually an unscientific assumption, because there's no particular reason to assume that unless you assume there's a unitary creator. Take someone like Einstein. Einstein certainly was a physicist that had a deep, deep understanding of the universe, perhaps one of the greatest who ever lived. Now, Einstein was very, very far from a traditional Jew. That, I'm not going to say Einstein put on tefillin every day. We know that he did not. Although, it's interesting that when Einstein grew up in an assimilated German family, he did not have any religious education. But when he was 12, around his bar mitzvah, he was actually flirting with orthodoxy. And he was thinking of kind of becoming a religious Jew on his own. Part of that is his own independent streak, because he was rebelling against everything around him. He eventually left that. It was a very short-lived experiment. But the one thing we have to say about Einstein is he had a deep, deep understanding that there was some intelligence, creative intelligence, that guided the laws of the universe. That is why, for example, many people feel that the last 30 years of his life he wasted, because after formulating the theory of general relativity and special relativity and Brownian motion and various other things, he spent the last 30 years of his life seeking what he called the consolidated field theory. in which all of the different forces, electromagnetism and strong force and weak force, kind of what we call the four forces of the universe, could somehow be united. And he worked on it, you know, Yomam Valayla, day and night, for years and years and years. And there were times that he was close to it, and then he was far away, and then it didn't work out. But he worked because there was a drive within him that convinced him that there was an intelligence, a unitary intelligence, from which the elegance of the universe proceeded. And every physicist will tell you that there is such a thing, but they haven't found it yet. But there's a drive to discover that. And indeed, if you talk to physicists, or if you've taken courses in modern physics, and again, I speak with a bit of trepidation because I am certainly not a great expert in this, sometimes a modern physicist sounds like a Kabbalist more than a scientist. They talk about string theory. They talk about the fact that instead of there being four dimensions, length, width, height, and time is also a dimension of matter, they will talk about 26 dimensions, many of which are compact. You know, we don't even know what that means, and they don't even know what that means. They cannot visually describe it, but they just have it through mathematical equations. Let me just mention that in string theory, in superstring theory, in compacted dimensions, you come up with numbers like 10 or a number like 26. Those are numbers that often get kicked around. Let me just point out that Kabbalistically, God's divine presence permeates the universe through the medium of what are called the 10 spheros, the 10 mystical spheres. And God's divine name, that's the tetragrammaton that we do not pronounce, the yud and the hey and the vav and the hey, that adds up gematria 26. So the fact that in the deep structure of the universe, we have this idea of 10 and this idea of 26 actually corresponds to spiritual realities. I knew a physicist, he's no longer alive, a great professor of physics at the University of Illinois, who was also a religious Jew and a bit of a Kabbalist. He was Sephardic, he was from Tunisia. And whenever he visited Israel, he would visit the Kabbalist yeshivot in Yerushalayim. Right? There are mystical yeshivos. Or Samech is not one of them, but you know, these are like very, very advanced places. And these old physicists, these old Kabbalists, who have certainly never gone to university and never even had a secular high school or elementary education, they study the holy books, you know, day and night. They ask the physicist, "What are you working on these days?" And the physicist was working on crystal structure, crystalline structures. And he was explaining his work, and they said to him, "Oh, okay, that's what you're up to? Okay, keep on going." You know, and, they already had a sense of all of these things. And again, listen to a physicist talk. It does not sound rational. It is supra-rational. Because the more we get into the deep structure of the universe, the more we see a mystical unity of the multiplicity of forces that ultimately converge and come from one. This was Einstein's intuition. And even an agnostic or an atheist like Stephen Hawking, who doesn't believe in God, is still pursuing this unitary structure. And again, I'm repeating my point. If you don't believe in some guiding intelligence, then why are you looking for a unitary structure? Why should there be a unitary structure? So the point of the matter is, every physicist believes in God, whether they believe it or not. In other words, the very quest is that quest for an ultimate unifying force that brings everything together. So in reality, scientific study, far from creating a conflict with religion, can actually be a source of deep, deep, deep spirituality. A sense of wonder, a sense of awe, a sense of reverence, a sense of beauty, symmetry, order, coordination. You see this on the macro level, you see it on the micro level. You see it in the flowers and the plants and the animals. And you see it in the atoms and the subatomic particles. You see a sense of unitary structure that creates wonder and reverence. That is a sense of holiness. One gets holiness from studying the Torah, and one can also get a certain degree of holiness from studying the world that God has created by looking at the Torah. Now, there is a very, very interesting midrashic teaching, a very, very famous rabbinical aphorism that records a tradition that the Torah predated the creation of the world by 2,000 years. And the Torah was the blueprint from which God created the world. God looked into the Torah and he created the world. Very odd. Meaning the Torah was not God's response to the world he created. The Torah was God's blueprint for the world he created. The way that's explained is, let's take a mitzvah like honoring parents. So we think, well, since there are parents in the world, that's the way we're born. We're born from parents. So that's a reality. So God gives us a commandment dealing with that reality to honor and respect our parents. But the cause and effect is actually reversed. The reason there are parents is because since the Torah says you got to honor your parents, so God had to create parents. In other words, God looked at the Torah as the basis for what he created in the world. Now, we don't fully understand that, but the basic idea is the Torah is not responding to the world, but the world is a response to the transcendental meaning of the Torah. Let me give you one example how the deep structures of science correspond to spiritual, theological truths of the Torah. And again, here I do proceed with trepidation, because I will be speaking a bit beyond my expertise, but I think the point is valid. You know that there are basically two different views of how we understand physics. There is classical Newtonian physics, formulated by the greatest of classical physicists, Sir Isaac Newton, in the 18th century. Newton invented calculus, although I can imagine that many high school students have eternal hatred to Newton for doing that, although there's a co-inventor, Leibniz. There's actually still an argument to this very day who gets credit or blame for inventing the discipline of calculus. Was it Leibniz or Newton? But whatever it is, Newton discovered the laws of optics, the laws of gravity. An amazing thing. Newton was truly a phenomenally gifted, brilliant scientist. One thing I'll tell you, a bit of trivia about Newton, that science was actually not Newton's greatest passion. People don't know this. Newton's greatest passion, strangely enough, was biblical interpretation. Newton left thousands of pages of his own commentaries on the Bible. And science was a little bit of a sideline. You can see what a genius he must have been that he could do what he did in science. And kind of that was a sideline. So Newton was fascinated with biblical interpretation, and he got in trouble because of this, because his biblical interpretations were not in accord with the Church of England. And he had to keep it secret and the like. But when we talk about Newtonian physics, that is what is called a deterministic system. There are laws, and if you have an identical stimulus acting on an identical object, and all things are equal, there will always be the same result. There will be stability. There will be predictability. Now, obviously, variables can change. And when variables change, either the force is different or the object is different, you're going to have a different result. But the lodestone of deterministic physics is the notion of absolute predictability and stability if all of the variables remain constant. Right, there are laws of gravity, laws of optics, and the like. This is called Newtonian physics, and Newtonian physics is enormously important. That is the basis of how we have airplanes, because if there wouldn't be some stable laws of nature that you can count on, I wouldn't be that comfortable going on a plane. I'm not that comfortable now going on a plane. But if, you know, if the law of gravity was, well, sometimes it goes up, sometimes it goes down, we wouldn't live in a very stable or safe world, right? So Newton is not the architect, but Newton is the describer, the identifier of the fundamental deterministic laws that govern the universe. Okay, Newtonian physics, deterministic system. In the beginning of the 20th century, let's talk about the early decades, 1910, 1920, into the 1930s, very great physicists like Niels Bohr and Einstein himself, although Einstein later rebelled from the movement, began to discover some very, very strange things. They began to discover that particles, particularly subatomic particles, did not always behave in predictable ways. If a given force were applied to a given particle, sometimes it went there, sometimes it went there, sometimes it went there, sometimes it didn't move, sometimes it disappeared, sometimes it doubled up. And there was no predictability. And the thesis was developed, this is called quantum mechanics, the thesis was developed that there is no such thing as a scientific law at all. All there is an assessment of probabilities. So Niels Bohr agreed that when you throw a pen up in the air, most of the time it's going to fall. But not because there's some immutable law that is called the law of gravity. Science cannot describe at all any stability or determinism in what happens. They can only describe in retrospect probabilities and then perhaps extrapolate to what the future probability would be. This is what is called an indeterminate system. This was actually a denial of the reality of scientific laws. And it basically said reality itself is uncertain. Right, this is quantum mechanics. Again, I am grossly oversimplifying because within quantum mechanics there were many, many schools. Einstein initially, through relativity, was one of the pioneers of quantum mechanics. But if you know Einstein's biography, you know that eventually he broke with that school. In fact, one of Einstein's most famous quotes was in German, but the English quote is, he doesn't believe that God plays dice with the universe. That Einstein was so convinced of a unitary guiding intelligence that he could not accept randomness or chaos as the ordering principle, or the disordering principle of the universe. So Einstein actually was in opposition to quantum mechanics, although it was his very theory of relativity that established the predicates of quantum mechanics. Okay, so now let's go back to normal life. If you would ask a physicist, who's right? Isaac Newton or Niels Bohr? Is the universe based on deterministic laws? Or is everything just a matter of probability and anything could happen at any time? So this is what a physicist might tell you. He would say, Newtonian physics governs big things and quantum mechanics governs little things. Meaning, when we're talking about a table, or a car, or a plane, or a train, or a rocket, Newtonian physics works perfectly well. We have stable, predictable laws of nature, in which, if an identical force is applied to an identical object, all things equal, you will always get the same result. Newton is correct when it comes to big stuff, but when it comes to subatomic stuff, we have quantum indeterminism. Both systems are right. Newton for the big stuff and quantum mechanics for the little stuff. Problem is, that makes no sense, to express it very simply, because big stuff is nothing more than a bunch of little stuff. I mean, I look at a table. The table is made up of atoms, and the atoms are made up of subatomic particles, and we identify new ones every time. So if you're going to tell me that when something happens to this table, it is always going to be predictable and deterministic, but those little critters that are running around and spinning around they behave in crazy ways. Well, the table equals the sum of trillions and trillions of these little critters. So if the little critters are running around like a chicken without a head, then how can the table as a whole have a stability? Right? How can you say deterministic for big stuff and randomness for little stuff if the big stuff is just a collection of little stuff? Again, I'm saying this in a non-scientific way. But it's a good question. Well, I'm not going to answer that question because I don't have an answer, and a physicist doesn't have an answer either. But I want to show you this mirrors a deep theological concept, the deep structure of physical reality, and the paradox that is embedded in physical reality expresses a paradox that is embedded in God's own Torah. And this is really a beautiful example of how the Torah was the blueprint for the deep structures of the physical universe. What do I mean? Okay, all of us know the following. All of us know that human beings are given the gift of free will. This is a very, very important idea. That although God is the creator of heaven and earth, and although on some level nothing happens without God, but we have the autonomy to decide to do good or to do evil. That's a fundamental principle. Maimonides articulates the idea that man is not predestined to be righteous or to be evil. Because if man were born in a predetermined state, how could he be punished for making the bad choices? And how could he be rewarded for making the good choices? He's simply a machine that has to behave one way or the other. In fact, this is a whole conflict now with the mapping and sequencing of the human genome, in which we are discovering that many types of behaviors have a genetic basis. So philosophers and California defense attorneys are now combing the genetic code to see, oh, my client has the axe murderer gene. How can he go to jail? Etc. Now, suffice it to say that that type of genetic determinism is a great oversimplification because nobody has an axe murderer gene. You may have a propensity towards anger, whatever it is, but you can control it. But we believe in free will. That's fundamental. And yet we have another proposition, that nothing happens in the universe unless God decrees it. So this is the great mystery. If a person walks into a 7-Eleven at 2 a.m. in the morning and gets shot by a robber, did God make the robber shoot that person? Certainly not. The robber could have decided to be righteous and not commit a crime, or commit a crime. God did not dictate that robber's choice. The robber was a free agent. On the other hand, we have a proposition that nobody dies unless God willed them to die. So God must have willed that person to die at that moment. But how would that work if the robber would have decided not to shoot the gun? And you can't say God made the robber shoot the gun, because that would be a contradiction to free will. But you can't say the robber killed somebody God didn't want to die at that moment for whatever reason. So there's kind of a paradox here between the notion of moral free will and the fact that God dictates the consequences that exist in the world at any given time. This is a difficult question. And again, there are different approaches to this question. But all I'm saying is that in a sense, it mirrors and reflects the paradox that you can have a deterministic system and a random system existing at the same time. Free choice is like a randomization factor, because free will means God is not dictating the result. I decide yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. So I'm like the quantum subatomic particle in the overall structure of the universe. And in the overall structure of the universe, there's a Newtonian determinism that we will call the hand of God, in which God clearly maps out what is supposed to happen. But the individual subcomponents of the system are not subject to that overall pattern because they have free will. In other words, we are like the subatomic particles, but the overall plan of what happens in the world is God's Newtonian physics? So I'm not answering that question either, right? That's a good question. But all I'm showing you is that the paradoxes that are built into the theological and moral structure of the Torah find their expression in the deep physical structures of the universe. An amazing thing. Paradox, contradiction. Of course, one of the fundamental ideas of life is that we have to learn to live with paradox and contradiction. That indeed that is part of the complexity of the universe, but also its beauty. And that is part of the idea that because God embodies all truths, God can sometimes embody contradictory truths, both of which are right, and we don't know how to reconcile them, but they find their reconciliation in the infinity of the divine. Okay, so this is just something to think about, and again, as I say, the more you delve into physics and biology, the structure of DNA and the like, the more you will be amazed at the beauty and the elegance and the simplicity that emerges from the complexity of the universe. So now, let me just take a very, very specific question and deal with it, and that is, let's deal with the age of the universe. Okay, let's deal with a concrete, physical question. And that is, we know that in the Jewish calendar, we are in the year 5,775. Right, this is the year 5,000. Now, what is that claim? Our claim is that Adam, after a creation process of 6 days, right, that God made the world, made the universe in 6 days, he rested on the Shabbos. And the last thing he did on the sixth day of creation, right before the Shabbos, is he fashioned a human being from the dust of the earth. He breathed into man a divine soul. And then later he separated man and woman, creating a woman. And the man is called Adam. The woman is called Chava. According to our tradition, that Friday was the first Rosh Hashanah. It was the first of Tishrei. And that is why Rosh Hashanah, to this very day, is a day of judgment, because it is the anniversary of the creation of mankind. And therefore, God judges us on the anniversary of our creation. So that happened 5,775 years ago, and preceding that was a mere 5 days. So as far as the Torah is literally concerned, the age of the universe is 5,775 years plus 5 days, because Rosh Hashanah, that is on the sixth day of creation. Well, obviously, most scientists, perhaps all scientists, are going to disagree with that. They're going to say that the age of the universe is billions of years old, and they'll even argue with the age of man. Now, man is not billions of years old, but they'll say mankind, Homo sapien, is at least 50,000 to 100,000 years old. So the numbers are way, way off track. So let me just mention a few different points here. There are many, many different points that one can use or one can understand. And again, all of this goes back to the fact that the Torah is not that interested in giving you an exact scientific description of reality. Number one, that wouldn't have been understood at the time anyway. Number two, we still don't understand it today. And number three, the Torah is about morality, ethics, and the fact that God created the universe in a purposeful way. As a result, there are a number of arguments that are made. Number one, according to Genesis, the sun was not created. The sun and the moon were not created until the fourth day. So as a result, when you have the first 3 days of creation, there is no particular reason to assume that it would be a 24-hour day, because the notion of 24 hours is simply based on the amount of time it takes the earth to rotate 360 degrees on its axis, which is measured from sunrise to sunrise or sunset to sunset, be a 24-hour period. Without a sun and a moon, it could have been longer. And remember, too, that the definition of a day is a function of the speed of the earth rotating on its axis, meaning a 360 degree rotation is the definition of a day. That's why in some planets, in fact, even in our existing solar system, you'll see there are planets where the rotation is slower. So a day might be equal to a month, right? So if one might assume, we don't have proof one way or the other, that the rotation of the Earth on its axis may have been at a different speed prior to the Sun and the Moon, then it's very, very possible that the first 3 days, each day might have been a billion years, you know, 10 billion years, whatever it is, because everything is a function of how long it takes for there to be a 360-degree revolution. So that's like one aspect, meaning a day, you see, a day is not 24 hours. That's a big mistake people make. A day is the amount of time it takes for a 360-degree revolution on an axis. It happens to be that it takes the Earth 24 hours to make such a revolution. But if that speed could be changed for various reasons, then a day could certainly be longer. Now, that's one approach. A second approach is this. There was actually a midrash going back thousands of years that actually says that God made worlds before this world. Because the problem basically is the following problem. You do have a certain problem. And that is, the Torah says in the beginning God created heaven and earth. Meaning God creates from nothing. This is called creation ex nihilo. Creation out of nothing. And yet the Torah says the world was formless and empty and jumbled and confused. And the Spirit of God hovered above the water. What's the water doing there? I mean, there was nothing. Until God created, there was nothingness. Why is there water that the Spirit of God is hovering over? So the Midrash says that God had created other worlds. And that doesn't mean other worlds, other planets. Meaning this world that God destroyed repeatedly. And therefore the Genesis story is not starting with the first world. There could have been X number of worlds before that. And that would explain cataclysms, ice ages, God destroyed. Exactly, you know, that would describe dinosaurs. Meaning, yes, the world as we know it with Adam. Now, I'll still describe the problem of the age of man. That's still a problem. Is 5,775 years old. But the age of the earth could be based on remnants of the prior worlds that God destroyed. Now, let me quantify that in an amazing numerical structure that one of the Kabbalistic works identified all the way back in the 11th century. And that is the following idea. There is a Kabbalistic idea that just as, you know, the sabbatical year, in fact this year in Israel is a sabbatical year where farmers are not supposed to farm, so you have 6 days and a Shabbos, 6 years and a Sabbath of the earth. There is a concept that the world will go through 6,000 years and then we will have the Shabbat of Mashiach. This is the source of the tradition that I'm sure you've heard, that the Mashiach must come before the year 6,000 because we finished the 6 days of creation in terms of the millennia, and then we have the Shabbat. So all of that is fine. That's a very familiar theme, that the six millennia, which will take us to the year 6,000, correspond to the 6 days of creation. And the seventh millennium corresponds to the Shabbos. That's the Messiah. But this Kabbalistic work goes further. In the Torah, you have 6 years and a Shemitah, 6 years and a Shemitah, but the cycle goes on seven times. Are you familiar with the Jubilee year? The Torah says that after seven cycles of seven, year number 50, you have what is called the Jubilee year, where slaves go free, property goes back to its original owners. Now we don't, for halachic reasons, we don't keep the Jubilee year today because that requires most of the Jews living in Israel, although we're pretty close to that. But you have every 7 years, seventh year is Shemitah, sabbatical. And after seven sevenths, you have the Jubilee. This is in the Torah. This is in Leviticus. In fact, those of you that are familiar with the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia, the famous verse, proclaim liberty throughout the land. is taken from Leviticus, and that is describing the Jubilee year when all slaves were automatically free. All of this is in the Chumash. This is not Kabbalah. But what the Kabbalist says is the following. The same way that there are seven sabbatical cycles, and then there's the Jubilee, so too the world will go through, the universe will go through seven cycles of creation, meaning 6,000 years, 1,000 years of redemption, and then the world gets recreated on a higher level. 6,000 years, 1,000 years of redemption, and then it gets recreated on a higher level. And that's going to happen seven times. Each time the world gets recreated on a higher and a higher level until you reach the Jubilee, which is the ultimate redemption and perfection of the universe. What cycle are we in? Right, we're in a 7,000 year cycle, okay? But which cycle are we in? So here I don't have any proof. I'm just telling you what the Sefer says. The Sefer doesn't really give us a proof. But the Sefer says we are in the second cycle. Meaning, before us, there was an earlier cycle of 7,000 years. There was 6 days of creation, 1,000 years of redemption, and we are in cycle number two. Well, that doesn't advance the ball very much. Because the most that means is you add to 5,775 another 7,000 years. That doesn't get you very much. But now listen to this. This is an amazing twist. Since there were no human beings in that first cycle, the measure of time is God time rather than man time. What is God time? Well, we have a verse in Psalms where King David says to God, 1,000 years in your eyes, God, is like a single day. You know the old joke about the person who is praying for money. And he said to God, "No, God, $1 trillion is like a penny in your eyes. You can't give me a penny. You can't give me a penny. All I want is a penny. Give me a penny. Because I, you know." So God said, "I'll be happy to. Just wait a minute. Just wait a minute." You know, it's kind of, you know, infinite time. All right. Now, this obviously is a mechanical conversion. I mean, God is infinite. But at least in Psalms, we have a dictionary conversion table. Day of God equals 1,000 years of man. Now, listen to this. If a day of God equals 1,000 years of man, then a year of God equals 365,000 man years. So if the prior cycle was 7,000 years old, because we're in the second cycle, and that is based on God time, not man time, then the age of that first cycle is 365,000 times 7,000. Anyone has a calculator here? 365,000, because that's the correspondence of a man year to God's year, right? God's year, 1 year of God, is 365,000 years of man, and that first cycle was 7,000. 365,000 times 7,000. Well, that will get you in the billions, the low billions. So, the point I'm making is this: that Kabbalistic books that were written hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago, before the Big Bang, before any of these scientific discoveries about the age of the universe, already understood that there's a whole hidden dimension of existence that goes beyond the literal time that is described in the Torah. And the Torah can be understood on multiple levels. First of all, as I said earlier, even the initial 6 days, certainly the first 3 days, the days could have been longer. But even if you say that those days are 24 hours, you have the prior worlds, which were operating on a different definition of time. And this is quite amazing. As I say, these are rabbinic sources that go back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. So as a result, we can live with all sorts of age of the earth theories, because the only claim we make, now I'll have to address that claim in a moment, the only claim we make is that Adam, the first man, was created on Rosh Hashanah 5,775 years ago. Now I'll address that, because that also is a question. And in terms of the 6 days of creation, and certainly in terms of what happened in the prior worlds that may have existed, we really can only speculate. We have some traditions, some insights, some interpretations, but we can live with all sorts of things. But we still have a bit of a question. Maybe it's not as big of a question as the age of the earth, and that as well. Okay, the age of Adam. Even if we say the only thing Judaism claims is that Adam was created 5,775 years ago, that still raises a problem, because we have fossil evidence and skeleton evidence of Homo sapien human beings walking the earth 20,000 years ago, 30,000 years ago, and the like. And then, of course, we have the issue of evolution as well. The Torah seems to negate evolution. God, Adam was made from the dirt, as opposed to saying Adam came from the apes and from the primates. And the like. So here, let me just say the following. And that is the idea that some have expressed. And again, these are controversial ideas. I don't mean to say everybody will agree with them. But they are possibilities. You see, the only thing I want to present to you is that you can be a faithful Jew by entertaining all of these different possibilities. They are not a challenge to your faith. I can't advocate which possibility is right. I don't know. I was not there. And science has many, many limitations. But the fact that these are interpretive possibilities should mean that they don't present a challenge to my faith. And here is the idea. When we say Adam was created, some have suggested he was not the first Homo sapien. There may have been other creatures who looked like a human being, who physiologically and biologically had the same characteristics as a human being, who even had advanced brains capable of tool making and the like. But the singularity of the human being lies not only in their intelligence and in their superior tool making ability, but we believe it is the singularity of the divine soul, a spark of God that is within them. That is not just a question of the brain. That is mind, that is consciousness, that is awareness, that is morality. And we believe that was a singular creation, meaning the way it worked was the following, in theory. You could have had a lot of humanoid people around. And that may go back 30,000 years, 50,000 years, 100,000 years. That may go back. But then God decided to take one of those many human beings and invest them with a divine spark. Quite amazing. Adam wakes up one day and he sees that he's different. He's not the same. He's divine. That all of those people, so to speak, are essentially advanced animals. And the singularity of Adam's creation is the divine soul, which cannot be explained, by the way, by evolution. Evolution could explain physical characteristics and the like. It cannot explain this emergence of divinity. And some want to say that this is the meaning. If you remember, there's a scene in Genesis where Adam is looking for a mate. And he cannot find a mate. And that's when God puts him to sleep, and God makes Eve from Adam. So what is Adam looking for? Is Adam thinking he's going to marry a cow? Or what, Adam's looking for a mate. What is he actually thinking? So some want to suggest He is looking at the Homo sapiens with whom yesterday he was the same as them. And now he sees there's an unbridgeable chasm between them. So the singularity of the creation of man lies in the divinity of his soul. And it is our position that that is 5,775 years old. But that does not deny the possibility of other Homo sapiens. Now, this does raise a host of questions. There are a lot of questions here. And that is, well, is it therefore automatically the case that all human beings are descended from Adam? If there were these other human people that were around, was there intermarriage or interbreeding between them? That does raise, I will admit you, that does raise some theological questions, because we say that the greatness of man is that man is made in the image of God. But if that only refers to Adam and Chava, once you have that other source into the genetic line, you run into certain difficulties. Were they destroyed at some point? Now we know the flood, but the question is, even until the flood, Noah himself, if Noah would be a product of some intermingling, you're going to have a problem there. Do we assume that once Adam had the divine soul, he only made it with Eve? Perhaps that's what the Torah is telling us, that the only partner he found was Chava. So I'm not suggesting at all that we have complete answers to these questions. But as I say, my goal is to simply give you interpretive possibilities. Now, if you are interested in pursuing issues about how to reconcile the Torah with the age of the earth, how to reconcile the Torah with the age of man, whether the Torah could accept evolution, again, the theory I'm telling you is that theoretically we could accept evolution as long as you believe it was guided and culminated in the divine soul, which in itself is not explainable by evolution. So there are many, many good books. Gerald Schroeder, as a doctorate from MIT, wrote a number of books on this. Natan Aviezer is a physicist at Bar-Ilan University. A friend of mine, Dr. Andrew Goldfinger, wrote a very excellent book, Thinking About Creation. There are other books as well. This is a topic that has been addressed extensively in English. But again, as I say, the ultimate bottom line is that these are not matters of deep religious faith, because you can have a deep religious faith in God and you can accept all of these different theories. Again, they're not ironclad. A lot of the theories might be wrong. I'm not suggesting any kedusha in these theories. But if you're convinced, so be it. You can still be a very good Jew at the same time. I'll just end with this. In A. Conan Doyle's first Sherlock Holmes book, A Study in Scarlet, so there's a little conversation between Dr. Watson and Sherlock Holmes. And Dr. Watson discovers that Holmes seems to be unaware of Copernicus' discovery, that Holmes seems to believe that the sun goes around the earth. And he's kind of incredulous. And he says to Sherlock Holmes, he says, Mr. Holmes, I can't believe that such a brilliant person like you simply doesn't know that the earth revolves around the sun. How could that be? And Holmes answered, in my line of work, it really doesn't make much of a difference. You know, let the earth go around the sun, let the sun go around the earth. That really does not change what I have to do with my life. And in many, many ways, although science is very interesting and it's religiously inspirational as well, but in some ways, whether it happened this way, whether it happened that way, doesn't make a difference to the life of a Jew. You still have that same sanctity of the soul and that same obligation of listening to God. It really doesn't change the picture one way or the other. Okay, take care. We'll see you later.